Hello and welcome, independent researchers, skeptics, and all of humankind, shadow citizens.
Welcome to episode 6. Today's guest is Deanna Spingola. You can listen to us live and chat with us over at mixlr.com/shadowcitizen. We're also simulcast on Radio Confluence, and from there you can take us with you on TuneIn and Zeno Live. My name is Rob O'Sell, and my co-host is...
Rachel L. McIntosh, and I am so excited once again that we have an awesome guest. We've only had this show for a little while, and every single guest we've had on our show has blown my mind. And this week's guest is equally outstanding. Her name is Deanna Spingola, and she has written an amazing series of books about the ruling elite, the people that actually run the planet. And it's incredibly well-researched, and that's the one thing that stuck out for me is how much research this woman did to do these books. There's three books in this series. The first one is The Ruling Elite, The Study of Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. The next one is The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. And I want to introduce everybody to this wonderful woman, Deanna Spingola. Thank you for being on our show, Deanna.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, good. Well, first off, a lot of people don't really know about this whole idea of the ruling elite. And if you want to just give us an overview of how you even got to even think about this topic, how did you even start?
Well, it actually started a few decades back when I thought, you know, something is really going on. There's things that are happening in the country, let alone the world, but in the country that just didn't seem to make sense. Representatives, the so-called representatives in Congress, didn't seem to be representing the best interests of the people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had the 1973 Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court, and I thought, well, that's horrible. That's absolutely terrible. And then there was the UN, and what's the UN? What are we doing with the United Nations? And of course, that was a spinoff. It was the successful entity that the League of Nations attempted to have. And I thought, well, you know, we're supposed to be an independent country. Why do we have the United Nations? Why are we paying for all of the, paying most of the expenses? Why is it here? And there were trade agreements and just all kinds of things that mm-hmm. just weren't right.
Right, and, right in your own lifetime. You just saw this starting to spring up and sure. You wanted to know, you go ahead.
Yes, and you know, so I joined what I thought was a good, I joined the John Birch Society.
Yes, I joined that for a little while too, myself. Go on, yep.
Because I thought, oh, they seem to be doing something. They really are doing something. And then I discovered that, well, gosh, they don't seem to be doing too much. They just seem to be talking about things. Mm-hmm, and the other thing, I didn't like the way that it operated. It just seemed like it was very, very structured, and they weren't really going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Although they had all these plans, we had billboards and we had this and we had that. It didn't go anywhere. It just seemed to be static.
So you were looking for more action.
More response, more something.
Something.
I wanted a solution. I knew there were problems, but I wanted to be a part of something that was actually leading to some sort of a solution.
And so, and that got you writing? Is that what prompted you to start looking into these things and write?
I really didn't start writing until 2005.
Uh-huh.
I just did a lot of reading. In fact, you mentioned Jim Perloff, who is I consider a very good friend of mine. And his was one of the first books that I read. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it when he was also associated with the John Birch Society.
Right.
And I thought, wow, this is really good. It was the shadows of government. You know, I've got so many books, but his was one of the first that I read. It was tremendous. It really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
And, but I was busy raising a family and, mm-hmm. and also I noted that even being a member of the John Birch Society made my friends look at me, well, like I was some sort of a tinfoil hat wearer. Mm-hmm. They thought it was, what are you doing? What are you doing? This isn't, because everybody that I knew was, well, although they were conservative and they were Christian and good people, when I was outraged over the Supreme Court decision in 1973, I mentioned it at church and to other women, and it was like, no big deal. And I'm thinking, what are you, crazy? This is no big deal? Because to me, it was a very big deal. It was such a big deal. And, mm-hmm. But anyway, I was raised, like I said, I was raising my children, and I went through a divorce, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. was, you know, kind of on my own and struggling. And so I didn't really start writing until 2005. And
okay.
Well, you must have done a lot of, you know, research. And how did you first come across, you know, that there isn't like an overstructure running the other governments? I mean, all governments of the world, there does seem to be a plan, a long-term plan. I mean, when you start looking at this, I don't know if it started with like the Balfour Declaration, which was, I don't know if you want to go into that at all, but yeah, we know that history is written by the victors, and so we don't always get an accurate view of what actually happened. And so that's why your books are somewhat controversial, because you look at history from you know, trying to be as accurate as possible, which isn't always easy to do.
Right. I think that I go back not just with, you mentioned the Balfour Declaration, which was associated with World War I. I go back even further. I began my research with the first major war in this country, which was, of course, the so-called Civil War. And what caused that? Why there was a war? Who was behind it? Who was promoting it? Who endorsed it? And who was fighting it? And also the groups of people who elected Lincoln. And I could go back to, you have to look at the 1848 Marxist revolutions in Europe. And, so it, you know, we think of ourselves as an independent nation, which of course we are an independent nation. Well, independent is kind of a tricky word here, but we see ourselves as a nation. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the things that go on in the rest of the world really do figure in to what has happened in this country, because you know, it just, you think, okay, well, who opened up Japan, and how come that was opened up, and No nation is without some sort of a interference or influence from an outside source. And it seems, you know, you have to look and see what that source is and who's directing it.
So all the way back to, you start at the Civil War in the United States.
You have to go back a little bit before that. Because you have to look at the things that happened prior to the so-called Civil War. Of course, you had the Mexican War, American-Mexican War, 1846. And how that started, what was going on there? And that was started by a false flag. And you have to look at the politicians who were in power, prior to, the so-called Civil War, prior to the Mexican-American War. And you have to look at their background, see who they were, see what they were about, who they were associating with. And of course, one of the first things I looked at was the banking industry.
Bingo.
Who was in charge of the banking industry? What was going on? And I covered this in my first book, which you already gave the name of, and that book is very interesting. Well, I thought it was interesting. It was interesting researching it. And right. That book is The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation, because all those things were going on even as early as the so-called Civil War. And
can I stop you for a moment? Can I ask
sure.
you a question? And
sure.
I have a feeling I know why you're saying this, but I don't think people in the audience will know. Why are you calling it the quote-unquote so-called Civil War?
Well, because a civil war is when two equal factions decide to have a battle, to mm-hmm. go into battle. And the so-called Civil War was also the first war that would be considered a total war. And by what I mean by total war is, prior to the so-called, I cannot call it the Civil War.
It's like part of your vocabulary. Yeah, I love it. All right, yeah, but yeah, explain to us. Go ahead.
Okay. Before that war, when there was a battle, there would be a battlefield. And the two factions, the two opposing factions would get together and they would fight each other. Soldiers against soldiers, led by generals and captains but they fought each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The so-called Civil War was total war, which means that the aggressor said, okay, everything is open. Kill the civilians, kill and destroy the pigs, horses, cattle, sheep, anything that moves, destroy their food production processes, destroy their agriculture, destroy everything. In other words, a scorched earth policy was employed during the so-called Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you, a lot of people don't realize that the war was not two factions that decided to go to war against each other. All of the battles, with the exception of two battles, took place in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that tell you? It tells you a lot of stuff. It tells you a lot of things. The two battles that took place in the North were Gettysburg and Antietam.
Mm-hmm.
Antietam was the bloodiest battle of the entire war.
Yeah.
I lost a second great-grandfather in that battle. But it was the bloodiest battle. Now, if all of the battles took place in the South, what would that tell you if you were critically thinking about it?
That they wanted to kill the South?
That the North decided to invade the South.
Yes.
The South did everything that it possibly could to avoid that war. They wanted to meet with Lincoln. They sent delegates. They wanted to send delegates to talk to Lincoln. He would have none of it. He had decided, we're going to have a war, and we're going to invade the South. The more accurate description or name for that war would be the War of Northern Aggression.
An aggression, yes, I've heard that. Now, I also heard that Lincoln really didn't give a hoot about slavery until maybe like the very last year.
Okay, it was not a
about
year.
Yeah.
Okay, slavery was practiced in the North.
Yeah.
As well as the South. Mm-hmm. And it was only a year after the war began that slavery even became an issue. Mm-hmm. It was not a war to free the slaves.
That's right.
And in fact, the declaration to free the slaves did not apply to the slaves in the North. It only applied to the slaves in the South.
You're kidding me. Wait a second. No. Hold the phone. Here I am at this age on this date, and I did not know that. I didn't know that it didn't apply to the people, the slaves in the North.
No, it didn't.
Well, even to this day, I mean, these films, the film that came out about Lincoln, you know, they're still trying to reinforce this thing that the Civil War was all about ending slavery, and it really had nothing to do with it. It's, the agriculture of the South, their exporting of cotton was, made the South very wealthy, and,
let's back up on that. What you had in the South was a cash crop. You had two cash crops. You had tobacco, but mainly you had cotton. Those are cash crops. Okay?
Okay.
And all of that, the people in the South, the growers in the South, used the people in the North and the ships from the North to take care. In other words, the North, people in the North were the middleman for the South. In other words, the South did not deal directly with its customers, for instance, in England.
They
went through the North. So the North, which had all of the bankers, because most of your bankers were initially in New Amsterdam or New York. And so the South was basically a colony of the North. And it's just like today, where you have Afghanistan, a country can produce most of what it needs, to feed the people in their country. The South could have done that. They could have produced enough food to feed the residents. But they were busy doing this cash crop. Okay? Mm-hmm. So when warfare came, they often did not have sufficient food. There were a lot of starvation. But also, you have to back up a bit and say, okay, well, how did this happen? What's the deal? Well, Jackson's Indian policies, I'm talking about Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Who a lot of people in the alternative media have made a hero. Well, he was not a hero. He was a slave owner. He was a planter, but his Indian policies literally made room for the plantations. And it was people from the North that went down and took over a lot of this land and created plantations. And it was a lot of his friends that did this.
Well, a lot of the people in the Patriot, you know, movement or whatever you want to call it, this truther movement, you know, they both, you know, point to, Jackson as, you know, I killed the banks, you know,
it was something he would share with
Lincoln though also, because Lincoln, you know, when he was going to borrow money for the war, they wanted to charge such exorbitant interest that he, you know, created the greenback and just said, you know, this is fiat currency.
Well, the greenback wasn't necessarily a good thing, because there are some stipulations with the greenback that were a little tricky. But let's get back to Andrew Jackson and the Rothschilds. Now, people say that he killed the bank and he did this and he did that. And he said that he called them a den of vipers. But when you get right down to it, he was literally working with the Rothschilds. He appointed the Rothschilds in England as fiscal agents for the government, which I cover in my first book. Mm-hmm. And so he made a deal with them. And as far as him saying that he killed the banks and all of that, there were some people that and that was a myth that occurred something like 40 years after the fact. He says he is supposed to have said, "You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out. And by the grace of the eternal God, I will rout you out." Quote unquote. And people regularly accept repetitive lies. And this was a lie. And there was recently a Time Article magazine not too recent, 1984, reinstated this myth. And this came from a privately printed 6-page book. There were 310 copies, and it was called Andrew Jackson and the Bank of the United States, written, in 1928, by a gentleman by the name of Stan V. Henkels, Jr. And he claims that his father, in 1883, so that was 60 years after, not quite 60 years after Jackson. But anyway, he said that he found the original minutes of the Philadelphia Citizens Committee, and that was a group of people who went to Washington in 1834 in order to talk to Jackson about the problem with the bankers. And you can read the official report. And, when in doubt, read the official report. If you think something is amiss, or if you think something, oh, gosh, that's a farce. That didn't happen. That school shooting was a big farce. Well, if you read the official reports, and people say, you can't trust those official reports. Well, there are a lot of good people who work as officials, and they do create reports. But anyway, the official report was printed on March 1st, 1834 in the Niles Weekly Register. Mm-hmm. Now, a politician's actions are more significant than his words. And in 1834, the Jackson administration, with his approval, was making a deal with the London Rothschilds. And this report, there were 10,259 Philadelphia residents who petitioned for the restoration of the Second Bank of the United States in that city. And so this 21 people took this petition to Washington in 1834. They met with Jackson to let him know the condition, the suffering, and the opinions of the constituents. And what had happened when Lincoln closed the Second Bank, he literally transferred all the funds to his good buddies up in New York. His banking buddies up in New York. I guess you could compare it to the 2008.
I was just going to say, the bailout.
Yes, the bailout. Okay, we're going to bail out our friends up in New York and to heck with the people in the South, or in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anyway, these 21 gentlemen, this committee, they wanted to get some relief because they had lost their pensions. They had lost, they lost a lot of stuff, property. And they wanted to recharter the bank because the bank was not under the control of the Rothschilds. It was kind of, it was a pretty decent institution. Anyway, the committee had several resolutions and what they wanted to do, was to stop Jackson's speculation and experimentation and all this nonsense that he was doing, And so they went to him and they said, you know, could you please, you know, restore the bank, because the bank had ceased paying the pensions. Meanwhile, the Treasury Secretary confiscated and removed all these public monies and put them up north. And so, you know, the Pennsylvania citizens who had voted for Jackson were saying, wow, what did we do? We put the wrong guy in. And as I mentioned, during the same time that this was going on, Jackson was making nice with the Rothschilds, and he appointed them as the bank to take care of any, the correspondent bank is what they called it, to take care of any loans or any monies in France and England that was owed to the U.S. government. And he did this through the Treasury Secretary, Levi Woodbury.
Okay.
And, but anyway, people say, you know, that he got rid of the banks. Yeah, he got rid of the banks that were helping the people. Mm-hmm. And then he collaborated with the Rothschilds. So, in this paper, you know, this 310 copies, written, you know, and, you know, it was supposed to have been based on a paper that somebody found. Well, you know, if you read the real minutes of what happened at the meeting, it's just totally different. But there were riots. There were all kinds of things going on. One of the first depressions that we had was in 1837. And it was because of Jackson's policies. And there were the 1837 depression was terrible. There were 147 riots just in 1835, and this was due to Jackson's refusal to recharter the bank. Citizens were angry because they had allocated, because these funds were allocated to Jackson's friends, and the bank owners had invested in speculative ventures and wanted to make a profit, and so they were just taking this money out of this bank and using it for the wrong purpose. And so there were all kinds of things going on, and the 1837 depression is a direct result of Jackson's political policies and his economic policies. And
now back to the Civil War, though, the so-called Civil War. Wasn't the Rothschild Bank funding both the North and the South with that?
No, they weren't funding them. There were people in the South, and this is a very long and convoluted story. They weren't funding both. There were influences in the South that were definitely from the North. And most of those influences were Freemasons, which is kind of
flat thinking. Okay, yep, go ahead.
Yes, they were Freemasons. And so what you had with the South was saying, hey, you know, this isn't working out too well for us. We seem to be, we have to go to the North every time we want anything. It seems like we're just doing all the work and we're not growing. We're not able to build infrastructure because all of our effort is going to creating a cash crop, which you can compare to, for instance, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Afghanistan could feed its own country. They could, you know, do all these wonderful things. Except they are forced to grow
the poppies for the heroin.
Poppies for the drug runners, the opium. And of course we know that the CIA is very, very heavily involved in that, as well as several of the leading families that instigated the warfare. Talking about the Bushes and the Clintons, and I mean, We're talking MENA airport and all the other things. But,
oh my gosh. So all of this filters back to the banks in your opinion? This of knowledge that you just put into three books comes back to the banks.
Not so much the banks.
Or the money.
And a lot of people, think, oh, the Federal Reserve, the Rothschilds own the Federal Reserve. Okay. That is not true. Okay. And there's another myth afloat that says that Congress went on holiday and six people passed the Federal Reserve Act. That is not true. And I cover this.
So the whole story of the creature of Jekyll Island is not true
some of it is true, but the part about let me just scroll down here. The Federal Reserve was passed by a majority quorum in Congress. It was definitely the money trust, okay? But Congress was in on it. It wasn't slipped through with, you know, three or four people, like they say.
So it didn't take...
Wasn't that vote on Christmas Eve?
No,
the Christmas break or something like that?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was in December.
Right.
But people are saying, they passed it and there wasn't enough people to pass it and only six people were there. That is totally not true.
Hang up the phone again. Oh my gosh, Deanna, you're blowing my mind. Okay, so how many people were there? How many people voted on it?
There was a majority quorum in both houses.
It was a full vote with a full, everybody was there.
Yes. And you see, the reason is, and you have to consider the time that this was passed and what happened right after that. And you have to look at, you know, what was going on, the Aldrich Plan. You have to look at so many different issues regarding this. But Congress passed the bank or passed the law, both houses passed it so that they could form the Federal Reserve, which would then be the funding entity for the war. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the Federal Reserve, is also audited. See, it's a corporation. The United States is a corporation.
Right.
And so people say, oh, we need to audit the Federal Reserve. Well, the Federal Reserve, because it is a corporation, is audited every year. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I
believe that it is too, but it's like a type of audit, like how many printers do we have? How much it's more like that sort of audit, isn't it? That happens every year.
No. The Federal Reserve is audited every year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the bill that everybody's been marching around for like, I don't know, 8 years now? Audit them. And you got Rand Paul now up there doing this.
Well, that's just a phony baloney.
Oh, okay.
See, I got a chance to talk to the Minneapolis Federal Reserve president. He was in my city and I actually went up and said, I said, you want to, you know, end this for me right now? We have this, you know, saying in the truther movement that goes, the Federal Reserve is about as federal as the Federal Express, and they have no reserves. Why doesn't the Federal Reserve say .gov instead of .org, you know, if it's part of the government? And he just looked and he said, well, Congress can end the charter to the Federal Reserve at any time.
Exactly, because they are the ones that passed it.
Right, so... But I don't know. I've had it explained as being, you know, more of kind of a, you know, a public private, you know, hybrid. It's, it's not totally, of the government, but it is, you know, it does have membership banks, and the membership banks are the largest shareholders. And so, I don't know.
Right. It isn't owned by private people, private owners. Okay? The Federal Reserve, and you're talking about the bill was 7837. It was passed on December 18th, 1913, with 54 yeas to 34 nays, with 7 not voting. Mm. It was passed by the House, and you had a majority. Now, in the House, you have 435 members, and you had 88 people there. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they figured, okay, on December 22nd, with 298, and that's a majority, to 60, on December 23rd in the Senate, you had 96 members, and there were 27 people did not vote. And then President Wilson signed the bill on December 23rd, 1913, and it is a bill that Congress signed. They signed it into law, and they can undo it if they so chose. But it is to their benefit to continue the Federal Reserve because it benefits them. They can mm-hmm. create a war anytime they want. They can raise interest rates, lower interest rates. You know, they can do anything they want. It's called the Money Trust, and it created the 1907 panic. Which caused the Congress to create the Federal Reserve to say, oh, we're not going to have another panic. We're not going to have another problem. We're going to create the Federal Reserve, and we're going to put the banks, get rid of the independent banks. And they blamed the independent banks for a lot of the problems. So they thought, okay, we're going to create the National Monetary Commission, and we're going to take care of all this. And so the Congress passed the bill as a Christmas present to the Money Trust, literally.
Wow. Deanna, how do you walk around and deal with, knowing what you know, how do you walk around to quote-unquote normal people who are going, oh, it was passed in the middle of the night and before the Christmas break, and it was totally like a conspiracy. How do you deal with, there's so many things that just in school, not only the conspiracy people, but the just going to school and learning about the Civil War. How do you deal with that? You have this body of knowledge that is so different than the other people walking around with you.
You have to choose, you have to pick your fights, you have to pick your friends. And I have friends that we talk about, they talk about shopping, and they talk, when you're with people who have absolutely no interest in any of this, you don't bring this kind of stuff up.
Right.
You don't, even if you have something really good, such as information about the so-called Civil War or about mm-hmm. the Federal Reserve or mm-hmm. whatever. Even if it's good, you want to instruct people about, oh, vaccines are bad. Don't vaccinate your kids. Presentation is everything.
That's right.
You can have a nice china, a porcelain plate with roses on it, a beautiful napkin, and a beautiful piece of chocolate, wonderful chocolate cake. And you can offer that plate to your friends with a lot of courtesy and consideration. Or you can shove the chocolate cake down their throat.
Right. It's true.
You have to know your audience, whether you're talking to your friends, whether you're talking to a group of people via the radio. Mm-hmm. You have to know your audience. You do not give people information that they are not prepared to swallow.
Right.
Well, this is the thing that I keep bringing up, is that, people that the system is working for them, that are living the good life, they really don't want to hear any of this. And, I've gone through this, quite a bit my whole life. And, but I don't know. I, This has been a road of discovery for me because I've been trying to figure out why the system isn't working for me, you know. But, you know, I, you know, Charles Lindbergh's father was a senator from Minnesota, and he was, you know, greatly opposed to the Federal Reserve Act. And you see things about, you know, Henry Ford, you know, you know, was totally against, the money trust. And apparently
we know what happened to Lindbergh's grandson. I mean, yeah, and he said the money trust caused the 1907 panic and thereby forced Congress to create a National Monetary Commission. Further, he said, the money trust would cause a money stringency in order to force the bill through Congress. This bill was passed by Congress as a Christmas present to the money trust. And he was against it, and he wrote articles of impeachment for members of the Federal Reserve Board. It just didn't work. And his grandson was kidnapped on March 1st, 1932, and they murdered him.
Yeah. Can I just ask this? How do you, from your perspective, when you saw all the Ron Paul people back in the day marching around with End the Fed signs, how did you take that?
Well, it was just exactly the same thing as when I was in the John Birch Society and they were saying, end the UN. Get the United States out of the UN. Mm-hmm. Well, they had no that was just their rhetoric.
Right.
They weren't really trying to get us out of the UN. They weren't really doing anything to get the United States out of the
mm-hmm.
UN. It
mm-hmm.
was just the rhetoric. It was the same with Ron Paul. It was just rhetoric. You know?
Do you think build the wall from Trump is rhetoric?
When I hear about building any wall, I say, is that to keep people out or keep people in? You have to look at things in a different way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's always been my point too. If they can't keep drugs out of prisons, you know what? Walls are meant to keep people in. They aren't meant to keep people out.
Yeah.
Did you see that? They had like a slingshot built on a wall, a current wall down Mexico to Texas, I think it was. And they found this like crazy slingshot thing built to this wall that they were putting marijuana in and catapulting over the wall.
And the other thing is you're only talking about a wall between Mexico and the United States. Well, what about all the other borders? I mean, seriously, this seems so. How is that going to work?
Yeah.
How
is it that we become a nation of, you know, band-aids? You know, because we have to look at, you know, what is causing the symptom. If we've got all these people up here looking for work, you know, isn't it time to go back and address what Ross Perot, you know, famously was this giant sucking sound, you know, that, we have to let the people from Mexico be able to, you know, make a living down there in other ways than selling drugs. But a lot of the people come up from Mexico because they're trying to, you know, save family property back home. A lot of the people that are working here from Mexico are sending money back to their families to try to support them. So,
the other thing too is that I worked on the Ross Perot campaign.
Yay!
But, and I still have my little Ross Perot button. But anyway, the bankers destroyed the peso in 1994. And that was the exact same time that they passed NAFTA. And I believe in timelines. And if you're going to kind of see some sort of cohesion in all the events, you have to create a timeline and you say, okay, let's see. They did NAFTA. They destroy the peso. Well, what do you think is going to happen? Hello? And if you send out a lot of production, which NAFTA did, which also there were other reasons for the corporations leaving the country. for cheaper labor, but it was also because at the very, very same time that they had the all these other things going on, that the corporations were hit with these very, very high insurance premiums,
right.
which came about at the end of World War II, because corporations wanted to offer these, some benefits and some things like that to try to enhance and to appeal to workers. And one of the things that they offered was, insurance. You know, medical insurance. Well, insurance is a big farce to begin with. It's all based on fear.
Tell me about it.
Okay. Yeah. I have not had an accident. I don't want to tell you how long, but the only accident that I ever had.
I'm going to knock on wood right now so that you don't get an accident today.
Okay. Yeah. But I have never had an automobile accident. I was hit. I was turning left and somebody decided to pass me, even though I had my signal on. But the only accident I ever had was one that I didn't cause, yet I've been paying insurance, car insurance, for, you know, several years, several decades,
mm-hmm.
For nothing.
Right.
It only enhances the insurance companies. And like with this Obamacare, they think, oh, we're going to get health insurance. That doesn't mean you're going to get health care. It just means you get to give the insurance companies money that
the
you
money.
Could have otherwise spent on vacations, or you could have put in a bank to provide for your own health care if you ever needed it. I mean, seriously, how many people really maximize their insurance? And the other thing too, when something becomes a law, like auto insurance, when it becomes a law, it becomes compulsory. That means that you're forced to buy something that you don't necessarily need. Now,
right.
How righteous, that sucks, okay?
Tell us how you really feel. No, but I agree. My father, he lived down in Florida till he died. And I remember he never had health insurance ever. We're like, oh my gosh. He's like, I jog every day. I eat right. And if I get sick, I'll just pay for the doctor.
Exactly.
And then he ended up dying in a plane crash. So there was pretty much, that was the end of that. There was no going to the hospital, having to get radiation or any of that stuff. So.
Sure. Well, when you consider that 880,000 people a year die because of their interaction with allopathic medicine, you have to ask yourself, do I really, really want to engage in allopathic medicine? Do I want to turn my body over to these people that kill 880,000 people a year?
That's an amazing fact. Just
yes.
That. That's an amazing fact.
I mean, that's more than they kill in military service, just about.
Yes.
I've been out of work for a year and started driving cab a couple of weeks ago, and I'm in the slow time period because the other you're paid by how much you drive and your
sure.
Your fares and that, but yeah, so I drive during the day, and more than half of my fares are picked up, paid by the county, their charges, and they're taking people from public housing to the hospital clinic, or a lot of people are going to dialysis. I mean, I've got several people that I, you know, take and, to dialysis back. And so this is all part of, I mean, and the hospital has just grown huge, you know, in the 10 years since I was there last. And it's always hustle, bustle. There's all kinds of people there, and it's just this whole medical thing. And, you know, and yeah, I don't know the amount of drugs that people are on, the vaccines, the high rate of autism that, you know, was non-existent
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid, are pretty much non-existent. But yeah, it's like we're creating, this new growth industry, of, you know, and the county and the government is just, you know, paying for it all. It's very strange.
Well, it's the same thing. It goes through the schools too. The kids are at school, and if they're acting up or if they're not doing well in a subject, next thing you know, they're getting not only a test to see if they could actually do math, they're getting a test, a psychological evaluation to see if they need a psych drug.
And so you have to ask yourself, why did the federal government create the Department of Education? And it is because schools that have the more children who are on medication or who they say are disadvantaged in some way, the more children that they have, the more the school gets in federal funds. So, and when you're talking about, you know, a certain entity or government paying for people to do something, I mean, we're talking about communism here, which goes back to the so-called Civil War. What did the so-called Civil War, institute? What were the consequences? It was corporatocracy, which was the result of the so-called Civil War. Because you have to look at all the legislation that occurred after that war. You have to look at the amendments that were created. You have to look at all the amendments, actually. But all the legislation. And, you know, just fixing one issue. Like, oh, we've got to audit the Federal Reserve. I mean, seriously, is that going to fix things? Is that really, really going to fix everything in the country to get an audit of the Federal Reserve? Or is doing one little thing? I mean, you have to look at the overall picture and say, what the heck is going on? Why is this happening? And it does seem to be a master plan.
A master plan moving us towards a communist type of...
we are a communist country.
Thank you.
The so-called Civil War was the first successful Bolshevik revolution in the world. The Marxist revolutions in Europe failed. They did not fail in the United States.
That's a fantastic quote. That's good.
It didn't immediately install communism because things have to be done incrementally. If they're done overnight, people are going to say, hey, wait a minute, hold everything. We're not accepting this. But if you do something, if you put the frog in cold water and then turn on the heat, it's incrementally. You're going to incrementally boil that frog. Same thing with anything that you're trying to attempt to do. You introduce it a little bit, like the health insurance scam. You introduce it right at the end of World War II when people are when corporations are trying to appeal to workers because they need a lot of workers. So some companies say, oh, let's offer this benefit and that benefit. And pretty soon it becomes like every single corporation, every single company has to have health insurance. Health insurance, you know, we often hear about how gigantic the military industrial complex is. It is not near as big as the health industry. The health industry is the biggest industry in the country.
Well, put it this way, it seems like all we make now as Americans is sick people.
Look at the commercials on TV.
90%
are for health products. So that is who owns the corporate media. Who's benefiting? Who is behind all this? Going back to, you know, I was talking about the Roe versus Wade 73, and then you had, you have the immigration policy of 1965, and then you have the Harvard Committee in 1969 that decided, oh, we're going to create a brand new category of death. We're going to call it brain dead so that we can start harvesting organs because, well, that's become a multi-billion dollar operation.
Hospital. You just gave me shivers because it's so creepy.
A hospital makes $11.1 million off of a body.
Wow.
You know, any time that you divide up something, like you take the cream out of the milk, you can charge for the cream and you can charge for the milk, you're going to make more money. Well, that's the same thing. This is terrible, but the same thing with bodies. You divide up a body, you know, heart goes for this much and a kidney goes for this much. And I just want to emphasize the fact that you cannot take a vital organ from a dead body.
Right.
That body has to be alive.
That was one of the other things that I've learned at the cab company here. The owner of the business said, oh yeah, he's gone out to the airport and picked up the harvester team. You know, they'll, bring in a team of surgeons that, you know, go in and do this. They take everything that, you know, they can from the body, and then they gotta fly out and get it to wherever it's going, right away, because the organs are only, and like you say, they have to come from a living body. And so this whole thing about brain death is, pretty spooky. I kinda even hate to bring this up, but now this is, another thing is that, police, when they shoot somebody, they're shooting them in the head now. They don't aim for the body, and they say, well, he might be wearing a bulletproof vest or something like that. So, but they go for the head shot, which, you know, they can leave the body alive that way, and or, you know, depending on how. But
well, even a head shot does not necessarily kill a person. You can get shot in the head, and you know, depending on where the bullet goes, doesn't necessarily mean that the person could not recover with proper medical care. But there is in 47 states, you are preemptively classified as an organ donor if you do not indicate that you do not want to be an organ donor. So this has become
I have to double check in my state where I live to see if I want to be an organ donor or not. And meanwhile, I know that my mother has marked on her license that she wants to be an organ donor, you're telling me that she will still be alive when they scoop those out of her.
You have to be alive.
Even though she's on her way out, but
if you're an organ donor, you're going to be harvested. It doesn't matter what. If you have an accident, even if you could live from that accident, if you're an organ donor, the ambulance that picks you up, retrieves you, from the scene of the accident, is going to take you to a trauma center where their job is to harvest you. Okay? Now this sounds
I feel like I want to vomit. This is incredible. Yeah. Go ahead, continue.
And they give you medications to prepare you. And when you're going to be harvested, I don't know how we got from the so-called Civil War.
And you know what? We've got 2 minutes left. And Deanna, you've been a great guest, but let's let everybody know you know, where they can get your books. You also do a radio show over at Republic Broadcasting Network. And when is your show?
My program is on Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m. Central Standard Time at RBN. And that's Republic Broadcasting Network. And we talk about all kinds of what you call controversial things. I don't think there's anything controversial about the truth. I think the truth is the truth. We talk about accurate history. We talk about all kinds of things that are very interesting, I think.
And your books, I saw them on Amazon. Is that the best place for people to get them, or should they go over to your website, or is there somewhere where you actually get more money for it than Amazon?
Well, I have my last book. I have 8 copies left of my last book in the trilogy. But I cannot compete with Amazon. It costs me more to purchase a book and resell it than it. So I recommend that they get them from Amazon. But I do have the 8 copies of my last book in a paperback edition.
Excellent.
And then I also have my book on Sandy Hook that is available.
Yeah, so we didn't even get to touch on that. That's what I wanted to talk about. Oh my gosh, we'll have to have you back on to talk about that book for sure. Oh my gosh, Deanna, you are awesome. Thank you for sharing all of this stuff. This conversation was great.
And
thank you for inviting me.
We didn't get to Rachel's tie color report.
Tie color report. Well, that means we were really engaged with what we were talking about. We were riffing. This is awesome. Everybody's like gripped to what you were saying. So thank you so much, Deanna.
Yes,
well, thank you. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah,
you
this
too.
Has been great. Thank you. And we won't even have time for a closing tune this time. But so who's our guest next time, Rachel? We have Catherine Austin Fitz.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I'm going to be so nervous. I'm going to be so nervous.
Oh, she's
I love her. I love her. She's my biggest hero ever.
She's a wonderful lady.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to that.